Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 18th of February. Every 10 years, we have a census here in this country. The Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution requires it. And it is very important. Who gets counted, how the people get counted, determines congressional representation, as you know, and also how funding is distributed for all kinds of federal programs that affect all of us. The U.S. Census Bureau kicked off the 2010 census on Monday of this week, and it will be mailing out a 10-question form to about 120 million households in this country in March. The form is one of the shortest in the history of the census. You'll be asked the number of people living in each household, ages, race, and whether they own their own home or rent. There is some controversy about the census. There's controversy about everything, so it stands to reason there would be some controversy about the census. We'll talk about that, about the reasons for the census, the importance of it, this hour of our program. We'll have two guests. Professor Margo Anderson is a professor of history and urban studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and author of a number of books, including The American Census, A Social History. She's author of Who Counts? The Politics of Census Taking in Contemporary America. Her recent work has been on statistical confidentiality and statistics and human rights. A little bit later, Professor James Gimple, professor of government at the University of Maryland, College Park, and he is the author of Patchwork Nation, Sectionalism and Political Change in American Politics. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. You'll be happy to know John Treader is returned for answering phones this Thursday. He has been off sick for quite some time, and some of you sent him cards. They were deeply appreciated, so please wish him well as you call in. 800-486-8655 is the number. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Margo Anderson, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Tell me about why the Constitution very specifically requires a census. What were the Founding Fathers thinking?
Well, in the 1787, they gathered in the summer that year in Philadelphia and to devise a new governmental structure. And there was a recognition that political power derived from the people, hence we start the Constitution with we the people of the United States. And the question was how to divvy up, if you will, the power among the states and among the localities within the states. And through the discussions that summer, they came up with the idea of actually counting people up, taking a census every 10 years, and using that mechanism with a mathematical apportionment formula to reapportion and redistrict the House of Representatives and the Electoral College every 10 years. And that's what we've done ever since.
So it's incredibly important in terms of representation, right? You want to fill out the census so your district will be represented fairly in Congress.
Right, and that's the major, that's the major logic for it, which is that there is a direct link between the political strength of your local geographic area your representation in Congress and based upon the population.
Mm-hmm. This year, we're getting a short form. I guess there are just 10 questions. As long as you're doing a census, why don't you get as much information as you can?
Well, the census has, over the past decade, sort of out of public view, actually changed its methodology so that all the information and a lot of the detail about what we call the characteristics of the population is still being collected, but it's been moved to another instrument called the American Community Survey, which is an ongoing rolling sample survey. I can describe it in detail, which is actually, as they say, in the field all the time, a couple, 100,000 households every month. So there's no longer a need to introduce all of those questions for what they call the decennial, for the count that actually is used to reapportion Congress and redistrict legislative districts.
There has been some controversy about the census. If you would address that just at the top here, conservative opponents saying that it asks too many questions, it reflects increasing government intrusion into private matters.
Right. And I always start by responding to this question by pointing out that that's a very, first of all, that's a very healthy response. Americans should not not question their government, and 10 years is a very long time, and most of us forget where we were on April 1st, 2000, much less April 1st, 1990. And so every decade, these questions come up again. Why did we do it? Is this necessary? Couldn't, you know, and there are often questions of cost and particular questions. So we have to work through them every decade. The answer has been that that once Americans have actually debated those issues, and in fact, of course, this debate really does take place in Congress in the years before the census is taken. So, in fact, Congress considered these matters in the middle years of the decade because it takes a long time to print census forms, and decided the structure that we have now. So that they were, in fact, democratically vetted, in 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2008.
Some political scientists had said it's not that people are mad at the census, but when you're mad at the government, you take it out on whatever is handy.
Right. Well, and that's also true. And what you've seen, some of what I do in my own historical work is talk about how particular questions are inflammatory in some years and not in others, right? And it's because of the way they resonate with what else is going on. So as it should be, because this is a political tool that is used to reapportion power,
right. Mm-hmm.
Just like an election does. So it's not surprising that people make the connection quite quickly once they think about it.
Do you imagine that there will be, putting politics into this, those states who have seen some kind of population increase, there will be a great push on the part of either Democrats or Republicans who would stand to benefit to make sure that their districts get out the vote? They may have ads. Can they do that? Would they do that?
Well, it probably not. the Census Bureau, as an administrative agency, organizes a very large public relations campaign, which we're in the midst of right now, which is why you're seeing all this advertising, and of course why we're talking about this right now on the air. They encourage every member of Congress, local politician, to become aware of the census and to be able to respond to constituent issues over this. There's very little room, frankly, for, in my view, sort of manipulation. Although, again, historically, there have been all sorts of shenanigans about local jurisdictions trying to sort of pad their census counts. But in general, it's a fairly small, it's not a big aspect of the process. You know, when counting, we're going to count, 308 million people.
Mm-hmm. The other controversy has been over the estimated 12 million illegal immigrants living mm-hmm. in the United States. Mm-hmm. Some political groups are saying that they should not sign up for mm-hmm. the census. What's that controversy?
Well, this actually goes right back to the question of the Constitution, because the framers in the 18th century had to wrestle with the question of the discrepancy between the politically active population, which at that point was a very small group of propertied white men, and the mechanics of actually counting the population. In other words, for electoral purposes, our rules for who can vote are very different from the rules from who we count in the population. What they worked through was they wanted to count everybody except for the caveats that are in the original Constitution. And they did not, at that point, make a distinction between people in the country, in some sense, legally. In fact, there were very weak notions of what citizenship actually meant at the time. And every time Congress and the administrations have confronted that issue, they have still decided on the most expansive rule. In other words, count everybody, count children, count women until, of course, 1920 had no political rights, and so that has been, the standard when people think about it. Now, the current controversy turns around whether there should be some way to identify people's citizenship status legally. And that that runs up against actually some real technical questions, which is how would you do it?
Right. How would you do it? That's a good question.
So if you think about 5 minutes on that, you realize,
Right. Right. So how are we going to get these forms? We're just going to get something in the mail?
Yep. You're going to. What the Census Bureau has been doing, sort of out of public view over the last couple of years, is making a very, very big address list, as you said, over 120 million addresses. They've canvassed, literally, the entire country, hopefully accurately. They've drawn maps, which is called the Tiger System. I can describe that if you like. And they will mail to each residential address in the country a form. Right? So, you know, nobody's going to get a, you know, the form won't come to your, by name, it will come to your street address.
Mm-hmm. And then how many, and then how do they make sure that you turn them in? Or you get a little knock on the door later, you didn't turn in your form?
What happens then, and this will start up in a couple of weeks, is that each form is, of course, barcoded, right? With, you know, so there's a check-in mechanism on it when it comes back, and you're supposed to put it back in, you know, the Postal Service and remail it. When the ones that don't come back, then you will, the first step will be that the Census Bureau will report the proportion of, you know, local jurisdictions and local areas that are coming in. So, you know, there's going to be a kind of race among municipalities and local areas, you know, aha, we've got 50% in, you people only have 40% in, that kind of thing. So, and that'll be on the Census Bureau website. After that, once they, in a few weeks into April, they decide that, okay, time to chase the rest of them down, they will send out enumerators. Now, what the enumerators then have to do is decide whether, one, people didn't fill out the form, or they lost it, or they never got it, or, in fact, nobody's living at the address, right? So it could be a vacant unit.
I see, yeah.
Right? Or it could be that the address was wrong, right? In other words, it went next door and so forth. So all
right.
of those, so that's what then the Census Bureau does until they, you know, through the late spring, until they, you know, they figure, they get everyone back, or as many as, you know, I mean, they try to get up to, you know, a ridiculously high rate of accuracy.
And what do they do? We speak so many languages in this country. What do they do about the language?
Well, and this is, there's a bunch of sort of strategies. One is, of course, to do a lot of advertising in local non-English media, so to raise awareness and to partner with local community groups and advocacy groups that can both speak the language and contact, you know, and contact the communities, if you will, and encourage and explain what's going on. The Census Bureau website has, this decade, has a fairly elaborate set of points that you can click, so you can get the census information, the form, and basic background in, you know, dozens and dozens of languages. And then finally, they try to hire enumerators who are multilingual.
Hmm. We take phone calls. Professor Margo Anderson, professor of history and urban studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, is our guest. The first part of the show, she is author of Who Counts? The Politics of Census Taking in Contemporary America. And we welcome phone calls at 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. David from Ashland is our first caller. Hi, David.
Hello. I was wondering if your guest can enlighten me on why the census workers came around last summer and GPSed everybody's doorway.
They did?
Yes. You're not aware of that?
No, I wasn't aware of that.
That's part of the address list preparation.
Huh.
That's what they were doing.
And what does that mean?
Okay. In order to be able to mail out the census form, they need an address list. So the address list needs to be linked, because we allocate political power geographically, to a piece of geography, right? So that there's a national map, right? A geographic information systems maps called the Tiger maps, topographically integrated geographic encoding referencing system. It's the same thing that UPS and, you know, delivery services and 911 use, right? And then each address has to be given a longitude and latitude code to map to connect to that map. So that's what they were doing.
They did that to every residence in the United States?
Yes.
Holy Toledo, what a job.
Yeah, that's the that's how you get a list of 120 million addresses by geocoded.
Well, some people live way out in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
Huh.
Well, I guess I find it rather disturbing. I mean, the guy with the GPS found my address, so why couldn't the form find it?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't trust big government. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. So that added to he's worried about the government looking at where he's living.
Well,
huh?
this is again the debate that we should be having. In other words, what they call the Tiger Map system, the map plus the master address file, was only created in the 1980s because you didn't have computers and the technology that could do it before then. It has been partnered with state and local governments and with the private sector for other uses, including emergency services.
Mm.
You know, fire.
Mm-hmm.
The emergency med techs and so forth. So and the 911 system. So that's done at the state and local level, not at the federal level. But in many ways it was states and local governments that were really quite happy to have this system developed by the federal government.
Well, it's sort of necessary to know where people are in that regard, right, for their safety.
Well, that was the political debate in the 1980s and 1990s. Should we do this?
Right.
It always creates the question of both, you know, a big government operation, right, on the one hand. I mean, that's true of Social Security as well.
Mm-hmm.
Or on the one hand, versus a kind of localism, you know, and our, because Americans really think very much about their local government. So the question is, should a local government be doing this, and how does one work out those arrangements? And that's exactly the kind of debate that has gone on over the last 20 years.
Professor Margo Anderson, more phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second part of this hour, we'll focus more on where it is that families and children live, what states are seeing an increase in population, and also we'll be looking at the age of the nation and how we continue to age. So baby boomers are getting up there in age, and what that means, we'll get a snapshot of how old we are. All right, we go back to phone calls now for Professor Margo Anderson. Jim from Greenfield, hi.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
I'm relating a story, something that happened to me in 2000, and I lived in an apartment building, and the only one that was living in it, and I repeatedly was getting inquiries and information dropped off at my door, and I think it must have taken at least four or five times before I guess they believed that I was the only one living there. So it was kind of annoying at the time.
These were people who just kept coming to the door?
Yeah, at least twice people came to the door. It might have been three times, and other times information was left for me to fill out, even though I had filled it out. So.
Professor?
Yeah, this is exactly the diligence of the Census Bureau, because on there were the other unoccupied units in the apartment building legitimate addresses? I mean, could somebody have lived there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so that's what they were doing. In other words, they were coming back to make sure that those units were really vacant. And unfortunately, because you were the only person there, you became the informant or the expert witness to document it. In other words, partially because the Census Bureau has gotten criticism that it hasn't followed up on units that really were occupied, right? In other words, really somebody was living there and that you missed it. they have gotten very, very persistent about determining vacancy status, and that's what you. I'm afraid that you were. You did your civic duty here, but that's it's really that was really just a function of the method that. Again, our political leadership has said, you know, you will find everybody, right?
How many census workers are there, Professor Anderson?
Many, 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 hundreds and hundreds of thousands. Because, again, what you're doing is a very, very short burst of work, right? And so if you're going to do it quickly, you need to hire a lot of people at once. And the reason you do it, we do it all at once. In the old days, as they say, the census used to drag on for months and months. But people move so frequently that say we ran it into the summer, you may not be living in the same place in August 15th that you were living in April 1st. So the idea is to do it, you know, to put huge amounts of manpower into the operation the follow-up operation right away and get it all over and done with, in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. Zach is next from Green Bay. Hi, Zach.
Good morning. Interesting conversation. A couple quick questions. First, why, in your opinion, why should I not look at the census as an intrusion on my privacy, given the intrusiveness of a lot of the questions, as opposed to just how many people are there, which seems to be the logical purpose of the census. From my understanding, there's lots and lots and lots of personal
questions. No, there isn't. There's
questions.
Only six questions.
And the quick second quick question, I'll let you get to them. In this time of economic, turmoil and mm-hmm. budget cuts, I'd like you to, if you haven't said it already, the amount of money being spent on the census as opposed to 10 years ago or 20 years ago mm-hmm. and some justification for what mm-hmm. seems like an outrageous expenditure.
Right. Yeah, no, both very good questions. The first one, first of all, it is a short-form census. You know, you're being asked your name, address, age, race and ethnic status, and relationship to the members of the household, and the whether you own or rent. That's it. That's all that's on it. The reason for that, again, were these were questions that were legislated by Congress. Right? So this was done, as I said earlier, 3 or 4 years ago in very quietly and in probably a very boring set of committee meetings, where the Census Bureau comes into to Congress. Congress is basically delegated the authority to make up the form to the Census Bureau. In the old days, they actually wrote the form on the floor of the House and the Senate, which was a hoot to watch. Now they delegate that to the Census Bureau. The Census Bureau works out a form, brings it to Congress. Congress then has a certain period to look at it and say, yeah, this is fine. So that all happened 3 or 4 years ago. So that's the reason. It is the Congress has also, in the statute, made response mandatory, right? And that goes back again to 1790. That was true. It's been true all the way along. It's been litigated. That issue has been litigated. The voluntary versus the mandatory nature to the Supreme Court. The last Supreme Court case directly on this was about 1960, and the Census Bureau won. The government won. So it could be relitigated as we do and so forth, because that was before really massive computerization.
Mm-hmm.
The second question is the cost, and you're right, it's very expensive. There was an effort in the middle of this decade to try a cost containment project and automate the census using small handheld computers. The contract was let to a private corporation. The technology failed. The Bush administration census director in 2008 therefore canceled that contract and went to Congress and said, we're going to have to pay, $3 or $4 billion more than we expect because this didn't work. Congress approved it, and, you know, all of that was done again in 2008 because decisions had to be made about printing census forms and buying other computers and so forth. So you're right. I mean, it is very expensive. There's already intense discussion going on about how we never do this again, and I would, in the same way that the old long form disappeared this decade, I would expect the 2020 census to look very different from what where we are now.
One more phone call for you. Karen from Duluth. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Something you said a little earlier struck me, and I asked your screener if it was a little too tangential, but based on the Supreme Court decision that corporations are people, so to
speak.
Right. Yeah, I just wonder if the Census Bureau folks and people that are in that sector might be part of the, well, just because I can't come up with a better word, a protest about it. We're doing all this work to make sure that people get equal treatment based on the population and you know, all this fine-tuning and spending all this money. And a lot of people, including myself, feel that some of this might be in vain, given that the corporations are going to represent, what, millions of people?
Again, this is what you're raising is a very interesting legal and sort of constitutional question, which I frankly think may come up in the future. I don't think the implications of it for the census are are going to be obvious. In other words, you've got a very large lumbering train leaving the station to go around and count people. The only thing that both the census officials and the public debate is how we're going to get through that in the next 2 months, 2 to 3 months. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if after that you come back and and address this issue and think about the relationship. What do we mean by people? Right, because that's the question you're raising.
Yeah. Well, there's a big question. What do we mean by people?
Right.
Thank you so much for being with us. First part of the show, Professor Margo Anderson.
Thank you.
Professor Margo Anderson, we're just changing guests now, and we will continue our phone call. For our new guest, our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We're talking about the census this hour of the program and welcoming your calls. There's been some controversy about this. It is, for just historical explanation, something that Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution requires. Who gets counted and how determines congressional representation, how funding is distributed for a number of federal programs. Joining us this part of the program is Professor James Gimple, a professor of government at the University of Maryland, College Park, where he has been doing research and teaching on American politics, political geography, voting and elections, state politics, U.S. immigration policy, and public opinion. He's co-author of Patchwork Nation, Sectionalism and Political Change in American Politics, and editor of American Politics Research, which focuses on American political behavior and institutions. The Patchwork Nation is interesting because it's looking at demographic changes in different parts of the country. So we'll be interested in finding out about minority share of the population in this country and how it is going up. We'll look at the aging of the population and how certain parts of the country are older than other parts of the country. And welcome your phone calls, as we always do. Professor James Gimple, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure, glad to be with you.
So one of the big changes that we're already seeing is the minority population growing rapidly in this country. Do you think the census will confirm that, and where is that happening?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. Latino population, Hispanic population will see major growth with the 2010 census. It might be about half of all of our growth, in fact.
Oh, my.
I think that it is happening in some places where we're not accustomed to seeing it. We see more Latinos, Hispanics moving into rural areas, outlying areas. They're already... A very large presence in suburbs, But we're seeing this immigrant diaspora into outlying areas and more settlement in rural areas, around areas of rural industry, for instance, in food processing. And I think probably there are some places in the Midwest, Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, that that fit.
Mm-hmm. What about the age? Are there certain parts of the country that are older than others?
Oh, I think that's true. The baby boomers, this big bulge in the age distribution, have hit retirement just in the last couple of years. We have the leading edge of the baby boom generation hitting retirement. That's going to continue into the next 10 years. But you're right, that's not uniform. I believe that the aging of the population will be most pronounced in northern, northeastern states, Rust Belt states. There will be some elderly enclaves, of course, in the South as a result of retirement migration. But in general, it's the northern part of the country where you see a lot of older people living on fixed incomes in small towns who really can't afford to move.
Mm-hmm.
And younger people, on the other hand, have left those areas for job opportunities elsewhere, often in the South and the West, leaving that older population behind. So I think the aging will be more pronounced in northern, northeastern states and midwestern states than it will be in the South, because the South is still attracting a lot of young people and a lot of economic growth.
Right. And so the South then will be increasing the number of congressional seats?
Well, I think so, particularly Texas. I think Florida will gain. I know that Florida has been hit hard by the foreclosure crisis and economic problems, as has North Carolina. But still, over the course of 10 years, there has been a lot of growth in both of those states, as well as in Texas, which has been less affected by the economic downturn. Interestingly, one of the things that I think we're beginning to learn from some preliminary figures is that there's been a leveling off of growth in California. California, of course, has been hit very hard by the present economic crisis and a huge number of foreclosures there. And the population growth in California, which has been so remarkable in previous censuses, is not going to be as dramatic. A lot of the California population seems to be moving into the mountain states, as well as the continued stream that flows northward into Oregon and Washington. But the growth in the mountain states, I think, will be quite remarkable. Colorado, Utah, Idaho, gaining a lot of population.
Mm. So what do you do if you're leaving California because the fiscal situation is so bad and you go to Colorado or Utah? What kind of jobs transfer to those places? What are those people doing?
Well, I think there's a perception that some of those states are largely rural and undeveloped. But, you know, places like Las Vegas and Salt Lake and the Denver area, these are big metropolises now, you know, where you can find just about any kind of employment that you'd want. The kind of old school stereotypes we have of these places as being cow towns, I think, is going by the wayside. We're going to have to update, put it this way, we're going to have to update a lot of our impressions of some of these places that maybe as kids we figured were sort of these desert outposts.
Right. And tell me your view of all that is encompassed with the results of the census. What it determines: congressional representation, money for programs, I'm sure. What else? What am I missing?
Well, I think that it has tremendous implications for business. You know, businesses study census data very carefully. And, for instance, one of the things that we're seeing is much greater race and class diversity emerging in the suburbs. Suburbs, again, we used to think of as white and upper income, but we now know that suburbs span the spectrum, probably right there in Milwaukee and other cities in the Midwest. You know, you can see very low-income suburbs and very affluent suburbs. We also know that there are suburbs that are quite diverse in their population, as well as the kind of traditional white suburb we used to think of or know. Well, the implication for business is that they have to be very careful how they segment those markets now. There's much less kind of mass advertising or mass marketing that can go on, where you don't differentiate your appeal the type of person that you're trying to reach. That was kind of, again, the old school of advertising where, you know, kind of one-size-fit-all approach, because one size did pretty much fit all. But with the increasing diversity that we see in these locations, we have to, in business, I think, customize our appeals to people's different tastes and values.
Let's go to phone calls. Alan from Boscobel now. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
I was just wondering if by making this big movement for collecting the data all at one time, if we would be able to have the information or like see the information on the Internet yet this year or by January of next year, as in the past it's, you know, typically taken longer, but it also takes longer to collect the data.
Yes, I think that the data collection, of course, is a mammoth, unbelievably complex undertaking. But we should be able to get some at least initial basic figures on population growth, age, the basics. We should be able to get those by the end of 2010, beginning of 2011. More detailed information on occupation, more detailed income information probably won't be until quite late in 2011 is my guess. As for the Internet, you're right. A lot of this is going to be accessible and disseminated over the Internet, which will be, you know, a big improvement over, you know, previous censuses where that technology was harder to use, not as easy.
Thanks, Alan, for the call. Here's an email. I don't remember quite so many politicians and pundits openly urging people to neglect their constitutional duty by not filling out the census the last time around. I'd like to know the extent to which this may stem from the same rabid anti-Obama sentiment in the right that appears to be stonewalling political progress in many areas. This week,
I understand what you're saying. I think it's really crazy to neglect the census. It is very important. It's important to not just the understanding of government officials as they make these resource allocation decisions, but again, it's very important for the private sector to have accurate information on population. So it's not like it's only the government that benefits from collecting census data. You know, many types of research enterprise require accurate and up-to-date census information. So I urge everyone to fill out their census data forms. There's no conspiracy out there, and it benefits people in business probably more so than it benefits people in government.
Professor James Gimple is with us this hour. He's author of Patchwork Nation, Sectionalism and Political Change in American Politics, professor of government at University of Maryland, College Park. More phone calls in a moment if you'd like to join us. Lines are filled, but they will open up in a moment. John Treader is answering phones again. We welcome him back. He has made quite a recovery here, and it's great to have him back answering phones. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Thursday, the author of Rock and Roll Jihad, A Muslim Rockstar's Revolution, Salman Ahmad, will be joining us. He is he's now with the band Janoon, which is generally known as the U2 of the Muslim world. He's a medical doctor by training. He travels the globe as a United Nations Goodwill Ambassador, grew up in Pakistan and the United States, and has some incredibly powerful stories to tell. Plus, we'll hear some of the music. So that's coming up, hour number two of our show. We go back to phone calls. Rob is next from Nina. Hi, Rob.
Hi. I would like to ask your guest what are the conservatives or the GOP afraid of here? I don't understand losing their electoral votes. Is that what it is?
You know, I don't really know. I think, you know, I don't visit those blogs. I could probably spend some time doing that, but I think my time is probably better spent elsewhere. But I suspect that there are some fringe elements that think that any kind of comprehensive data collection is a possible threat, that we don't want the government to collect information on us or about us. But remember that the census is collecting pretty basic types of information. You are guaranteed confidentiality, and the kind of information they're asking about is not the kind of sensitive stuff that people should be concerned about. And things that I think concern people in surveys typically go to health history or possibly criminal background or, you know, that drunken disorderly conduct charge you had when you were in college or a DWI on your record. Well, the census doesn't ask any information about that, nor does the census ask any questions about religion. So, you know, things that people are sensitive about are not required information, are not even asked in the census. The census is really quite harmless, and yet it is of tremendous value to both business and government, and that's why it's so important to all of us.
Mm-hmm. It's just this ridiculous fear that, I don't know, the government's going to come and get us, or I'm not sure what it is, but as far as I'm concerned, it's way out there.
Yeah, and the census doesn't ask us about our politics either. Now, lots of pollsters ask us about our party identification and who we like in the coming election. But that's, you know, that's all private data collection. The government and the census don't ask about your politics, your political views.
Thanks, Rob, for the call. Barbara from Eau Claire. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
My question today is how are those that are incarcerated or institutionalized in some other way accounted for?
Yeah, that's a good question. They are counted. There is a census item called institutionalized and group quarters populations, and those are counts specifically geared toward people who are incarcerated, people who live in nursing homes. And so, you know, they do get counted, as well as other kind of group homes. You know, they definitely get a count. That's, you know, separate from how they're treated, you know, politically. Like, there's, I think, still a prohibition against felons voting. So, you know, they might not be able to vote, but they're definitely counted.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara. Here's another email. If illegal citizens are counted in the census, are these numbers counted in determining the number of representatives in the Congress?
Yes, they are. And it's good that someone raised that, actually, because it's kind of a controversial matter that illegal immigrants would not only be counted in the census, but that they would also be counted for apportionment purposes. There are some states, mostly states in the Midwest. I don't think Wisconsin is one of them, but Ohio might be. You know, there are some states that could lose congressional seats because of growth in the immigrant and specifically illegal immigrant population in some other states. And I think that, you know, if I were in the Midwest and I were going to lose a congressional seat because of this, it would upset me. So, you know, I'm glad that that question came up, because it is something that I think requires some thought and some further discussion. You know, yes, we are counting these folks, but should they count in the apportionment of congressional seats? I think that's the issue. You know, there are in California a number of congressional districts that are comprised largely of illegal immigrants who can't vote. And, you know, if I lost a member of Congress in my state to, you know, one of those districts, you know, I don't know how I'd feel about that.
Mm. And so the reason for including those people is to make sure services are delivered.
Well, you know, the Constitution says we have to count the full number of people. It doesn't say we have to count the full number of illegally admitted people or native-born people. It says the full number of people. I think this is, you know, why we continue to do it. Now, we don't inquire in the census of their illegal status. You know, we don't have a question on there asking them whether they got here legally or not. But we do count them. And we,
yes.
Okay. And we also count them in for purposes of apportionment. And there are states, again, mainly in the Midwest and Northeast, that have lost seats because of the illegal immigrant population mainly in the Southwest.
Jerry from Madison, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, are businesses that use this information, are they required to pay for it? It seems like it would be a good way to recoup some of the cost of administering the census if they were.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point. Well, I think for the most part, the census information is available to everyone for free. And with contemporary, computing technology, it's become easier and easier to use it. If you go back in time to the 1910 or the 1920 census, in order to use it, you had to go to these big fat books and pore over them, you know, for hours to find what you needed, and it wasn't very easy to use it. Well, now a lot of the information comes out on CD and now DVD, and it's much more accessible, and it's mostly free, except maybe for the cost of the media, like the DVD itself or the CD. I think that there are a lot of firms out there that repackage the census data, possibly augment it with some other information, and then sell it to people. But no, businesses don't have to ordinarily pay for the use of the census, and private individuals don't either.
How is the homeless population counted? An email asks, and how does that affect the political weight of each area, city council, et cetera? City, county?
Well, you know, fortunately, the homeless population is still pretty small, but I know census takers do try to, you know, do the best they can. I think it's always a problem if someone genuinely is homeless, you know, to get them included because, you know, if they're homeless, naturally, they don't have a residence. And yet, while a lot of them are missed, I think there's some effort. I don't know in detail what those efforts entail, but there is some effort to try to count them.
Somebody has asked about detailed forms. He's received some in the past, questions about, I don't know if he's being facetious here or not, the number of toilets, et cetera, in the house. If I get such a detailed form, do I have to answer all such personal questions? They won't get them this year, will they?
Well, a lot of that information is being collected by another kind of instrument now called the American Community Survey. But one of the products that the census puts out is a periodic detailed housing report. A report on the characteristics of households and housing. And that includes some detailed questions like the number of rooms and the number of bathrooms and so forth. So that, you know, information is probably not very important to you and I, but I think it is important to those who study the quality and newness of the housing stock and the characteristics of the housing that's being built. So I think that's why that information is collected. I think you're right. The long form has been replaced again with this American Community Survey, which is primarily conducted over the phone, I believe.
Mm. I'm wondering, as you look at what's happening all over the country with the results of the census, are there certain things that you're just intensely curious about? You can't wait for the information to come out so you can see some kind of big trend taking place.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think we want to look at the continuation or possibly any upticks or downturns in longer-term trends. For instance, in Wisconsin, we might be interested in knowing about the further consolidation of agriculture. We also might be interested in the aging of the farm population. We know that a lot of young people have been leaving the farms behind. They're not interested in getting into farming or taking over the farm that their parents owned and ran. And what that means is that these aging farmers are then putting their land up for sale, and that leads to further consolidation of agriculture, more corporate farming, less family farming, and again, the overall aging of the farm population. So I think that's really very interesting, and I would be curious to know what that looks like if I were in Wisconsin. But there are lots of other things. I think this movement of Hispanics and immigrants into rural areas is pretty interesting. One of the stereotypes we have of rural America is that it's a place that's kind of hostile to diversity, that it's not very friendly to outsiders. And yet, you know, these the trends of Latinos and immigrants in Iowa and Minnesota and Wisconsin moving into rural America suggests that, hey, maybe they're finding a pretty gracious welcome there after all. And so it's an opportunity to revisit some of our impressions and stereotypes we have of places.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for being with us. You taught us a lot.
Well, I appreciate being on, and you know, I'll be back if you want some more.
Okay. Well, thanks. We'll call you.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Our guest this half hour, Professor James Gimple. He's a professor of government at the University of Maryland, College Park, research and teaching interests, American politics, political geography, voting, and elections. He co-authored the book Patchwork Nations, Sectionalism and Political Change in American Politics. We also thank Professor Margot Anderson for being with us from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Her book is Who Counts? The Politics of Census Taking in Contemporary America. Thanks to Chrissy Peace for producing this program. And thanks to John Treader for answering phones and Connor O'Brien for looking after the emails. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Thursday conversation here on the Ideas Network.